Hey listeners, Movie Miss here, wanting to thank you for joining us for the Unlocked Patreon episode re-release of a season 2 favorite, one of our most streamed episodes. It is on the non-turkey The Lost Boys, and we covered this film in season 2 with co-host Nikki Flix as her birthday pick. So it didn't have to be a turkey, so that was a lot of fun talking about The Lost Boys. I thought in honor of her birthday, as she is not resident co-host anymore, she is going to be popping in from time to time. Had an episode in season 3 with us, Children of the Corn 2, which was so much fun, and I highly recommend you check that one out if you enjoy the show, and especially Nikki Flix. So I thought, you know, in honor of her, I would go ahead and re-release this, unlock it from our Patreon. But I tell you what, over 100 listening hours of content over there on the Patreon. Not only is it all of season 1, all of season 2, the bonus episodes, and fresh content exclusive for the Patreon. New episodes coming in February on the Patreon that will not be available on the main feed. So please check us out. It's only $3 a month for access to everything. It's patreon.com/letstalkturkeys. And now, please enjoy this unlocked episode in honor of Nikki Flix.
Baby, you are gonna go broke showing turkeys like these.
It's turkey time. Gobble, gobble.
Welcome, everybody, to a very special episode of Let's Talk Turkeys. This episode is in honor of the birthday of our own Miss Nikki Flix. I'm Movie Miss, and how are you today, ma'am?
I'm feeling immortal. Ageless, I guess.
So we are going to be discussing, in honor of her 21st birthday, I let her choose the movie, and it is not a turkey, so before y'all go crazy, we know it is not a turkey. But for her birthday pick, we've got, do you want to tell everybody what movie you chose?
Yes. This is one of those movies, if someone asks me, what's your favorite movie, I have such a hard time answering that question. But if you give me about 30 seconds, I'll say, okay, I can give you my top five. And this is in my top five forever. And it is The Lost Boys.
Yes, ma'am, from 1987. I'm happy that you chose this because it's not a turkey and we probably wouldn't really talk about it. The sequels, however, which we'll touch on later, are definitely turkeys. But this one is a classic and beloved. And I want to say it's more than just Gen X. It's more than just the people who grew up on it, because I belong to a Facebook group who loves The Lost Boys called Lost Fans of The Lost Boys. They have like over 40,000 members.
Yeah, well, I can
People
confirm.
Love this movie.
Yeah, can confirm that this movie has a timelessness and a awesomeness that transcends the 80s for sure. My kid is firmly Gen Z and she loves it. Everyone she ever showed it to loved it and thought it was badass. It's highly rewatchable and kids today still love and adore this movie as they should.
So let's jump into it. Rotten Tomato critic score of 77% and an audience of 85, as it should be.
Yes, definitely.
It has a 97-minute runtime and was directed by Joel Schumacher. It had a budget of $8.5 million, and it shot mostly in and around California, which you can tell if you're from the region especially. They used their budget well. I think a lot of it went to special effects and makeup for the vampires, which I love.
Definitely, yeah. I like that they didn't do a ton of visual effects. It's not really CGI at that point. Super, super creative in giving you what the vampires are doing, but without using a lot of visual effects. So I think they kept the budget pretty damn small by steering away from too many green screen shots of flying vampires and such, which was smart because, right, you know, they needed a lot of money for the amazing costuming in this movie and the amazing locations in this movie. And there's just so much stuff that was good decisions everywhere. It was money well spent.
So it did a box office of 32.2. And then, of course, billions on home video and merchandising.
Mm-hmm. I'm probably a cool 100,000 of that money. I've bought so many copies of this movie over the years.
Right, right. Me too. And I just stumbled across, and this is so great, I just have to side note mention it. There's somebody on Etsy who makes cutouts that you can either download and print yourself, or they print them for you. And it's each of the vampires all hanging from the trellis from mm-hmm. the movie, the train or trussle. Yeah. And it's really cool because it's all of them. And it looks like a party garland almost. So just okay, for random.
Send me a link, because that needs to go up like in my dining room.
Right.
Year round. It'll look great with my severed head. Sounds good. Let's do it.
Really fun.
Birthday gift idea for Nikki Flick. Somebody send me the link. I need to buy that. That sounds fabulous.
That's pretty great. So, okay. Apparently, they originally approached, Warner Brothers did, Richard Donner to direct this. And he had pitched for the cast to be mainly all 13 and 14-year-olds, kind of like Goonies meets vampires. And personally, I don't see it. I like that they went older.
Right.
For the majority.
Agreed. And it makes sense that that's where the original idea was, with the title and some of the themes, you know, vampirism as a substitute for puberty, things like that. But I appreciate that they went with the 18-year-old. Michael looks like he's supposed to be 17, 18. The rest of the vampires, you know, yeah, they're okay. More sinister. Children don't do scary quite as well.
So top billed cast, Jason Patrick, Corey Haim, Kiefer Sutherland, Corey Feldman, Jameson Newlander, and Diane Wiest. And we can get to everybody else as we go. The IMDb plot. After moving to a new town, two brothers discover that the area is a haven for vampires.
I'm not mad at it. You are correct, whoever wrote that. They could have stuck in another sentence, the greatest vampire film of all time, fight me, period.
All right, our story begins with a sweeping shot, and we're supposed to surmise that this is the vampires POV flying over the water toward the kind of carnival situation they have going on the pier at the coast there. And it's supposed to be the city of Santa Carla, this beautiful pier on the coast, night view flying over water. This shot immediately sucks you in. You're like, okay, here we go. We're sweeping in. And you get opening credits, some opening credits, and title card. And then you can tell that Schumacher, even if you don't like Batman and Robin or Batman Forever, he did Flatliners, he did The Phantom of the Opera movie adaptation. And those are all films visually that tell a unique story. He always has a unique vision with each movie he does, I think.
Agreed. He has a very interesting perspective, and he has a very unique and artistic way of deciding how to film and shoot things, particularly the decision to do the POV shots of the flying. I love it. I mean, it was probably done because of budgetary reasons and intentionally not wanting to use a lot of visual effects and stuff, just kind of leave it to the imagination, but it works so well. And it's used for sure. Over and over again to great effect in so many scenes in this movie. Combine that with it was edited so well. It's put together so proper. I love it. It just looks so good. It's such a treat for your eyes. It's gorgeous. And the music, how can you not love the music? The first of many uses of Cry Little Sister by Gerard McMahon, which is incredible. And they use the hell out of that song in this movie.
And
I love it.
It's effective every time.
Yeah. Every single time it's effective. Yeah. It sets a mood.
So we zoom in now on the, do you call it a carousel or a merry-go-round?
I call them carousels.
Me too. Okay.
So we zoom in.
Oh my God. We zoom in on the carousel. I'm going to harp on this. Visually, this shot is just stunning because we get kind of slow-mo. We meet David and his gang of vampires. We don't know they're vampires yet, but all the people around them looking authentic, the shot visually, and you know immediately what's happening. These guys stand out, the way they're dressed,
right.
With the black, the trench coats, the hair. To me, they look like a Whitesnake cover band.
Exactly.
Like, I want to call them like Garden Snake, you know, like they're a substitute.
Exactly. The people, Corn Snake, the people who made the decisions as far as costuming, casting, hair, how it's lit, how they're shot, that little bit of slow-mo that kind of makes them appear kind of ethereal every time they're on screen and moving. Jesus Christ, it's already, you're what, 30 seconds in, and they're presenting vampires in a way you haven't seen them before. It is so original. They're giving them this rock and roll weirdness that just, oh, okay. I see where they're going with this. And I love it. I have never been so in love with a mullet in my life. Kiefer Sutherland, if you're out there listening to this, beautiful to look at. Every single one of them. Gorgeous.
So they tussle with a local tough guy briefly before getting booted off of the ride by a local cop. I don't know, beat cop or just like the pier cop. I don't know what he is.
In these kind of areas, you would need actual police, not just security. Just saying.
Is that what he is? Is he like security?
It looks like he's security slash an actual cop. I mean, you got a lot of
Paul Blart.
A lot of sketchy types in an area like this, particularly after dark.
So later now, after the boardwalk has shut down, that security cop guy gets attacked. And it's in the parking lot. It's an assailant from above. And again, scary and effective. But I did pause it and look really quick and to see, is this movie R or PG-13? Because I felt super cheated. And it's actually R. So I was wondering halfway through this movie, it finally kicks into gear. But I'm like, this kill was so blah. I thought, oh my God, am I watching a PG-13 movie right now?
To me, if you go back and look at the movie as a whole, it feels as if, pun intended, you are making your way up the first incline on a roller coaster. The first half of the movie feels like that. Every glimmer you get of violence from the vampires or an attack or they're coming around, they're doing something, it just becomes more and more threatening and menacing. And so I think it's meant to make you feel like, wait, what just happened? Did anything bad happen? I couldn't even tell. It happened so fast. There was no blood. The sound, though, I love the use of the sound. It sounds like a bat swooping in. If you've ever been swooped on by a bat, it's fucking terrifying.
Everybody raise your hand.
The sounds, it's happened to me. The sounds they make are very similar to the sounds we're hearing. So you're getting the idea, but without seeing anything yet. And I actually appreciate that because it builds the tension. So I think it's intentional.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
And the R rating is there so that when you get the money shots and you get the payoff, it comes in spades. And it does.
So now we cut to a sunny day and we see a family in a car driving down Pacific Coast Highway there with a little U-Haul trailer on the back. And this is Lucy and her sons, Michael and Sam, and their beautiful Alaskan Malamute dog, Nanook. Oh, I want that dog.
Right. I know.
More credits roll over movie, as you appreciate.
And we get Echo and the Bunnymen's cover of People Are Strange.
Yes.
So freaking great. The soundtrack, I cannot say enough things about this soundtrack. I mean, this soundtrack inspired my eternal love of NXS. but also, this is if you're going to do a cover, this is how you do it. I love it.
Agreed. And in this scene, we get a quick little exposition dump. We find out that Lucy is divorced and they're moving from Phoenix to Santa Carla to stay with her father for a while. And in this scene also, we see Michael look over his shoulder and notice a billboard. And on the back is painted the words, Santa Carla is the murder capital of the world. great.
Yikes. Yeah.
So then we get, as that song plays, like you mentioned, lots of shots of random, very interesting looking people doing various activities around town here. My favorite, most notably, is the woman who is French kissing a rat.
Right. Yeah. Okay. What's that about?
What is going on there? We also get a glimpse of a nice wall covered in missing posters of children that are missing, just to put that into our minds.
Yeah, keeping in mind that Joel Schumacher, as we said, is very visual. I fucking love the idea that he's going with, which is just give you a ton of quick visuals to set the scene and give you a lot of information without having to say anything. Just get to it. Get to the vampires.
I see a theme here with the movies we've been doing recently. You're like, let's get to the action.
Let's go. Yep. Don't need a ton of exposition. And the weird people around town and how dumpy and sketchy it looks and all the missing people. You're like, okay, so is what he saw on that billboard correct? Because it sure looks like it.
So as the credits and the song end, we see Lucy and her boys arrive at her father's somewhat out of the way home. And to me, immediately, I wrote down in my notes, looks like something out of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because we see taxidermy animals outside, the wood cabin feel, abandoned looking almost.
Like I said before, that whoever it was that scouted these locations, whoever is doing the set design, the cinematography, Jesus Christ, like everything is just so well done. That house tells a story and has a character to it. There are many locations in the movie that seem to have their own personality and character. And I love that when everything that you can use to tell the story is being used to tell the story.
So yeah, Grandpa plays a prank on the family, and this made me fucking love that actor. And Grandpa is Barnard Hughes, and he's laying there on the front porch playing possum. So of course, you know, Lucy and the boys approach him, and he jump scares him. And I just love his sense of humor.
Definitely. I love Barnard Hughes. He had quite a laundry list of credits under his belt. He's fantastic, but he's just cast so brilliantly. Everyone is cast as the character. It just suits the actor so well. And that cracks me up. That is such a great introduction. Great way to establish what he's like.
Well, you know, we'll get to it later, but I'll mention it right now since you just said that. I did pause it. My husband was watching some of this with me when I was taking notes, and I had to look at him and say, you know, there's a scene with the Frog Brothers and Sam, Corey Haim. And I was like, you know, if you were to right now swap them and swap the roles, it doesn't work for me. Because Corey Haim has this sweetness about him and this innocence about him. And Jameson Newlander and Corey Feldman have this hardness, like they've been through it. Even though they're so young, they're like, what, 14, 15? There's no way you swap anybody in this movie. And it exactly works the same, right?
Yep. Everybody is so perfectly cast. And to me, even though I'm obsessed with and in love with Kiefer Sutherland as David, like he makes the movie for me, I can't help but just instantly fall in love with Corey Haim from the time he comes on screen to the time the movie's over, because he's just so damn adorable and natural and silly and goofy. And he makes the movie. All yeah. These years later, I look at it and I'm like, he is the best thing in this movie. I think he's just wonderful.
I thought it was his wardrobe, but
okay. Well, we'll talk about that as we get to it. Like, the costuming is fantastic, and they basically reinvented how vampires should look. However, knowing how smart they are, what the hell were they doing to Corey Haim? I would love to know kind of story are they telling, but I digress.
So as they're unloading their belongings here, I really just laugh because when they go in, the boys mention that Grandpa has a really cool place, sure, for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I was like, oh my God, I just wrote that.
It's what I was just thinking.
Yes. So that was fantastic. So then in the scene, we also get some info. We learn that their family's totally broke from the divorce. Sam is very disappointed that he won't get to watch MTV anytime soon because Grandpa doesn't own a TV.
Well, when you read the TV guide, you don't need a TV.
This is true. I do enjoy the dynamic also, the relationship between the brothers, because Michael, in this scene as well, shows you he pulls off being the sweetest big brother, but he's also very masculine, you know, as well. And it's that nice blend of being sweet to my brother, but I'm still the older brother. Does that make sense?
Definitely. The two of them have really, really wonderful chemistry. Physically, they look like they're related. Whoever did the casting just nailed it with every single person. And Michael really, you know, he's supposed to be your central character, your most relatable character. I find myself as in love with him as this character as I am with everybody else. I don't even know who to choose because they're all just so brilliant.
Well, I was kind of happy for Nanook because he also gets to live his best life. He's out there running with the horses.
Yes.
That was so good.
They may be broke, but Nanook doesn't notice. He's just happy he has horses to play with.
So the boys stumble into Grandpa's taxidermy room, and he is not happy about it. And he decides to run down the rules of the house now for the boys. Tell me what you think of these rules here. Rule number one, the second shelf in the fridge is for his stuff only.
And is labeled old fart.
How many times in your life have you shared living quarters with somebody and you wanted to make a little flap for a shelf like that?
Oh yeah, definitely. I'm right there with him. I think I am Grandpa at this point.
So I'm going to randomly throw this out there too, because being a Gen Xer, I was, you know, young and eating crap as a teenager during this time when the movie came out. Those peanut butter boppers by Nature Valley.
Oh my God.
Do you remember those?
Yes. Those things slapped. They
were fucking great.
Right? Somebody bring them back.
Well, I did happen to Google Nature Valley's website, and they have a recipe to make those at home.
No shit. So not only have I figured out what I want for my birthday, I also figured out that I don't want cake. I want boppers. That's what I want.
It can happen. So then rule number two, I love this because it sort of gets muted out because Michael talks over him, but I have captioning, so I caught it. Rule number two, he says, don't touch anything. What?
Don't touch anything, literally anything in the house.
Yeah. But Michael interrupts him and says, is it true that Santa Carla is the murder capital of the world? And Grandpa's response cracks me up.
If all the corpses around here were to suddenly stand up, we'd have a hell of a population problem. He sort of just accepts that that's just how it is. And now we understand why he lives in this house in the middle of fucking nowhere. He wants to be as far away from that shit as possible. And he's a smart man.
And then we get rule number three. When the TV guide comes, don't peel the label off and don't tear my cover. I love how excited Sam gets for a hot second. Like, do you have a TV?
There is something so beautiful about Corey Haim looking genuinely excited. I cannot describe it. I cannot put it into words. There's just like this magic on his face and in his eyes and the way his little mouth hangs open. There's something about his face. He just had this charmed look about him. He just looks like a little magical creature. He looks like a little unicorn.
I typically, and I don't know, maybe it's the cold-hearted part of me, but maybe it's because I don't know them, but I don't really care that much when celebrities die. When we lost Corey Haim, I swear a little piece of my heart truly broke. He was so amazing.
He was a very, very talented kid. You could see it. Yeah. You could see it from his first early performances. Yep.
Yeah.
And this to me is just him at his absolute peak. This was peak Corey Haim as far as his acting, because he just makes you smile. The minute you see him get excited, you just smile.
And then of course, rule number four, stay out of his taxidermy room. And boy, has he got a scary looking situation in there. He is Norman Bates times 100. So later that night, we get another beautiful sweeping water shot as we go toward the boardwalk. We hear those bat sounds that you were talking about, and the song I Still Believe starts to play as we zoom in on a crowd of people standing around a stage watching a live performance.
Sax man. That
Tim
is all.
Capello. Tim Capello. Yes. Sax man.
The man has gone down in infamy just for this one quick little scene, this brief little appearance. I mean, he's a wonderful musician. He's a well-known saxophone player and composer. He toured with Tina Turner and all kinds of people for years and years. He's had a stellar career, but literally this is what he's known for. Sax man with the oiled up buff bod.
And the chain and the around his neck and the ponytail. Yeah. Yes.
It works for me. I would be digging this show, honestly. Right? I'd be into it.
So Sam and Michael are out there standing in the crowd and everyone's enjoying the performance when a young woman and a young boy pass by. He stares at her as she starts to enjoy the show, and that's Jamie Gertz. She turns to leave after making eye contact with Michael, and so he and Sam follow. I get being interested in somebody, but it always kind of bugged me that he's kind of supposed to be there looking out for Sam, and he's like, whatever, hot chick.
He is a teenager, and
true.
I mean, when you're the difference between maybe 14 and 17, 18, come on. You're a completely different person. You're verging on adulthood. 14, you're just barely becoming a teenager. Michael has different priorities than Sam. And do you really want your little brother around cramping your style? You're trying to talk to this beautiful woman. True. Get the hell away from me. Go find something else to do.
So then we see their mom, Lucy, walking around on the boardwalk, and she goes into a video rental store. Wow. Blast from the past. And
an antique museum.
Nostalgia.
I know, the video store with all the different displays and the posters. And I did notice when she walked in, there was a giant poster for A European Vacation right behind her on the wall.
We just connected the turkey verse.
There you go. Yep.
Did you notice the girl working behind the counter?
Yeah, Kelly Jo Minter. I love her. From again, summer school.
Connecting the turkey verse.
She was Denise. Yep.
So Lucy asks for the store owner to see, because she found a little boy outside who thought he lost his mother. And that turns out to be a lost boy. That turns out to be Max. And he tells her there's a job opening. She looks like she's looking for a job. And she says, well, as a matter of fact, I am. That's kind of a meet cute. I like it, because he's all, oh, you have such a nurturing, whatever he says, presents or something sweet to her.
Yep.
And I'm like, she really does, right? Like, if we didn't have a mom, I would want her to be my mom.
Exactly. Diane Wiest, we haven't talked enough about her. She has a natural sweetness and warmth that it's the same quality I'm talking about with Corey Haim. There's just this light and sweetness and warmth that emanates from her, but she can also do it all. She can do piss. She can do, you're suspicious. I can't trust this person, but she just generally glows. And then Edward Herrmann as Max. Holy crap.
Yes.
What a great piece of casting. I love it. Everybody who's listened to our show knows. I love when you get bamboozled by a movie. And then if you go back on hindsight, you're like, okay, it actually did all track. Even though I didn't see it the first time, I see it now. He rides that line where you really don't know what's going on with him. And he does it brilliantly.
Agreed. And then he was on, I never watched it, but wasn't he on the Gilmore Girls?
I did not watch that show either.
I guess there's a lot of love on the internet for him for that show. And it almost makes me want to watch it because I love him. So we'll see. All right. So back outside now, Sam has wandered into a comic shop and he meets the children of the owners. And that is the Frog Brothers, Edgar and Alan. And that's Corey Feldman and Jameson Newlander, who are equally and individually brilliant in this movie. For sure.
They work very, very well together. They look like brothers and they work very, very well together. They obviously, like, what a couple of little method actors as teenagers. They clearly went and got to know each other and developed a rapport, whether that was they were smart enough to do it or Joel Schumacher told them to do it. They work really well together. And then the three of them playing off each other, they're like the three Stooges with the dialogue. It is comedy gold watching Corey Haim play off the two of them and they his have sarcasm.
Some amazing. Yes. Yes.
He's comedic sarcastic.
Yes, he is. They have some great banter here. And you can tell that initially they don't like each other. None of these boys are not going to get along is what you're thinking right out the gate here. So one of the Frog Brothers hands him a comic book and it says vampires everywhere. And this was a side note where I was happy that my husband was sitting with me because he's a comic book nerd. He had to look it up. And I guess the cover for this one and the one that they show later, the covers and the inner pages were designed by Jay Oliver and Chris Miller exclusively for this movie. These are not real comic books. And then you can tell in the corner, the tag for the publishing company is Blackthorn. Apparently that's a company that makes comic books and books for movies. In the end, that's just what they do.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was wildly interesting, actually. So I started Googling and looking it up, and you can find props and replicas of these comics all over the place. And that's so fun. All right. So now back to Michael and Sam have reconnected outside, and they're following that girl and the young boy. And then they see them get on motorcycles with David and his gang, and they ride off after Michael and David exchange a look.
Sam is following Michael, who's following Star, because he is at the mercy of his sex glands. It's one of my favorite lines in the movie.
Agreed.
And then I adore the way we're getting, once again, so much being told visually. Just glances, looks, eye contact, facial expressions. You can't tell a story with just that if you have not so great actors or actors who don't have chemistry. Everyone works so well together. And nobody does menacing quite like Kiefer Sutherland. It is so much fun to watch.
No, isn't it weird to think of all the roles he's played over the years? And some of them are so polar opposite.
He's just a fantastic actor. I mean, he's always had that level of talent. I wish that he could have gotten better recognition as a film actor. I feel like he's been underappreciated and maybe hasn't gotten the kind of roles he should have gotten.
Until 24.
But see, then you're talking TV. This man is such a great actor. I feel like he deserves to have an Oscar on his mantle. He's that good. He is of that caliber, and he just has never had the role that gave him that opportunity. But yes, 24. How many Emmys does he have?
Oh, I didn't look that up. I should have, because he deserves every one of them.
Yes, absolutely.
So now later, that couple that had a confrontation on the boardwalk at the beginning of the movie, they're in their car and they get killed. And again, this is a really cool scene where we don't see the vampires attack them. But like you said, you've explained it well. They're revving up to something.
It goes on a little longer. It's noisier. It appears to be a little more menacing and violent. whoever that actress is. It's a very brief role, but man, is she a scream queen. She screams bloody murder when the camera descends on her, and to look at terror on her face, you're like, okay, this is a little more intense than what we saw before. There's definitely like, those are some fucking flying vampires attacking people. I know it. I know it. I can tell.
So then we get this really funny, quick, nothing scene, really, with Grandpa and Sam in the car. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And I'm so glad it's in here.
How can it not be?
Because so how many times have you quoted that over the years?
Exactly. And like I said,
what?
I'm Grandpa at this point. Look at that beautiful car. Let's go to town.
That's as close to town as I like to get.
Yep. Same, Grandpa.
Sam is so defeated. He's like, I wanted to go somewhere. But it was funny because I looked at my husband and winked when that scene rolled, because I say that to him and he had no idea where I got that from when I'd go, let's go to town.
Pretty sure one of the reasons I knew I wanted to marry my husband was because I said that to him and he said, well, that's as close to town as I have to get, and pretended like he was going to turn off the car. And I was like, oh, we're a match made in heaven, aren't we? Because that's the best movie ever.
You're a match made in heaven if he has a severed head in the dining room and he's okay with that.
Yes, this is true as well.
So we cut now to Sam back at this comic shop, where again, the Frog Brothers try to push another vampire comic on him and tell him it's a survival manual. You're gonna need it if you live here. Our phone number's on the back. He tells them that they serve a higher purpose and they just work in the comic shop as a cover.
It's just a cover.
And they tell him to pray. He never needs to call them.
Well, he may need to call them if he's in need of help from someone who's dedicated to truth, justice, and the American way. My favorite thing about that is, one, how serious Corey Feldman is when he says that. Two, the way that Corey Haim just goes, all right, after he says it, like, he just looks like, you guys need medication. Get away from me.
And then he goes, and I'll pray. I never need to call you. Sure.
Comedic sarcastic.
But it's, again, you couldn't swap roles, because his delivery of that, it's just a Corey Haim thing.
And of course, this is the first appearance on screen of the two Coreys, and you're starting to see they have a wonderful chemistry. They're playing off each other really well. Props to Jameson Newlander, because he is, you know, the third wheel on that tricycle.
But he manages to stand out and shine many times during this film on his own.
Absolutely. It wouldn't be the same if it was just Edgar.
So now Michael is buying a leather jacket on the boardwalk, and then he's contemplating getting his ear pierced when he runs into Jamie Gertz again, and she introduces herself as Star. And at first she agrees to go for a ride with him on his bike, but then David and the gang roll up and shut that shit down. And this confused me. It's not a spoiler for the movie, because if you're listening to this, you've already seen the movie. Later, when she confronts him and says to Michael, you were supposed to be my first kill. How was she going to ride off with him and kill him, but David shuts it down? Why wouldn't David let her go here? Why did David stop her? That always has confused me for decades.
When she first saw him, maybe it was, oh, who was that guy following you around? The first time he saw David and they saw Michael. And she went, oh, he's just, you know, just a guy and whatever. She was kind of into him and he was following her around. And maybe at that point she was told, well, maybe he would make a good first for you, because, you know, you still haven't killed anybody yet. Okay, so maybe that's why she's talking with him and gonna go with him. But I think there's something to it when David looks at Michael this time and they exchange glances. We know in hindsight, Max has told them, these two boys in particular need to be brought in, because he has a master plan about getting Lucy, and that is to get her boys and turn them into vampires, not to kill them. So he has come in and told David, instructed him, you need to take him under your wing and make him one of us. So now he has flipped the script.
I never thought of that.
It was just a coincidence that Star happened to see him and they found each other attractive. That was just a coincidence. She didn't know who he is. She doesn't know what the plan is.
That never occurred to me, that David is shutting it down, because now David knows she can't go kill him.
Exactly. And it is also the reason why she very, very unhappily keeps her mouth shut and lets David do what he does to Michael. She's been told that she cannot stop them.
Well, holy shit. Decades later, and I just figured something new out because of you.
Mind blown.
Blown.
It only comes from having watched this thousands of times. During this scene, though, I have to go back to the music again, because we have the second great song from NXS with Jimmy Barnes, which is Good Times. It is actually my favorite song on the soundtrack. I am obsessed with NXS, and I absolutely love this soundtrack. I listen to it all the time. Best song on the soundtrack, fight me. Sorry.
I would agree with you that the soundtrack is amazing. That's not my favorite song, but yeah, the soundtrack kicks ass. So now we're going to get another one, Lost in the Shadows, The Lost Boys by Lou Gramm, who is the lead singer of Foreigner. And right. This song kicks ass.
Absolutely, it does.
David has challenged Michael to keep up with them as they race their bikes, wildly unsafe, toward a cliff over the sand here. It's a fun scene, but it's just so dangerous, you boys.
You stop that right now. Well, you know, they do have that whole immortality thing going for them. So they fly off the cliff, they're just going to keep flying.
So as the song fades out, this is amazing filmmaking again. We get the eerie sounds, the fog, the lighting as they get closer and closer to the edge and the dangers just amping up. And they all stop suddenly before going over the edge. What an amazing, 2 minutes of film.
Yep. The way the whole scene with the motorcycles is shot, the tight shots, the close-ups of the faces, and then the sweeping shots as we're following. And there's this really amazing shot where the camera tracks in front of them underneath the pier. And you feel like you're on the back of a bike watching them. Like, it's so cool. And the way they build the tension as you're approaching the cliff, like, just every single thing about this movie is so good decisions everywhere.
So tensions are high. And Michael jumps up and punches David and challenges him to a fight. But we just cut, though. So this, to me, was an abrupt cut. They cut to David and Michael and the gang now entering their underground lair, where I guess they all live. And suddenly they're BFFs.
The way it's the look.
Just going to fight.
Michael punches David for doing that to him. And David just looks right back at him and just smiles like, oh, okay, maybe I like you. Maybe this is going to be fun. Like, you were a chore that I have to complete, a task I have to complete. But okay, maybe we can have some fun here. I like that. He liked getting punched in the face. Who does that? He's insane. And obviously, Michael has a dark side and he has a bit of a temper. And so he's a little intrigued by these people and he's still wanting Star. So he's going to just go along with them. You know what? Sorry about that. We were just having some fun. Why don't you come see where we hang out? He's going to go with them.
Okay. So now we're in this underground lair for a minute before we cut away. And I have to mention some of the decor in here. Trash can fires, always a good sign.
Yep.
We have a mobile hanging in the middle made of starfish and seashells. And there's some surfboards. There's a poster from the Munsters on the wall. There's mm-hmm. birds flying loose and bird shit on the walls. Like, this place is different.
So I love appreciating the details here, because if you think about it, first of all, it's a cave, a lair. It's where bats would go to hang out and sleep and be safe away from the sunlight. But it also looks like a bunch of homeless teenagers decorated it. And is that not what they are? A bunch of family-less, parentless, homeless, muckabout forever teenagers. So of course
Lost
that's what it
boys,
looks like.
If you will. Lost boys.
Exactly. So, and it has a mood. It has a presence. There's a feeling in this location, the way that it looks, the way that it's shot. It sets a tone. I love it.
Did you notice the big Jim Morrison banner hanging in the back?
Of course I did. How could you not?
Which I thought was funny because, you know, of his song on the soundtrack that they covered. Okay, so now we cut to Lucy tucking Sam in. Can we talk about his room for a minute?
I was just going to say, so we were just raving about set decoration. And then you see this. And this you have to think, every fucking thing in that room has to be intentional. There's no two ways around it. It's all on purpose. So what are they trying to say? You got this sexy poster of Rob Lowe on the closet
yes!
door. And then this bizarre close-up of Molly Ringwald's face from 16 Candles on the other wall. What the fuck is happening? The giant clock that looks like a watch. What?
And I also noticed, and this is neither here nor there really, but he has one ear pierced and his hair is frosted. And he doesn't dress super butch like his older brother. So I thought, was this subtle ways of working in a young boy who is
perhaps curious about his sexuality or his gender identity?
And so, I thought, how ahead of its time is that? It's subtle.
There are so many like articles on the internet and people in groups who discuss this. Is there some sort of subtle questioning or gayness or queerness about Sam's character? And were those choices in the costume, set design, the hair intentional? It has to be, because look how painstakingly meticulous everything else is. So I love it and I run with it and go with it. In my head, that is definitely what is happening. This right. adorable little Gaby is just on the verge of figuring out who he is and what life's about and who he's into. And apparently he's into a lot of things if you look around on his walls.
Yes.
Including reform school girls.
He puts the Q in the LGBTQ.
I think it's adorable.
I love it.
That makes him so charming and sweet. Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing he doesn't like though is getting his grandfather's taxidermied animals hand delivered to his bedroom every night.
The back and forth of him looking at it and it looking back at him. So funny.
Agreed. So now back in the vampire hotel, David messes with Michael as they trick him. And I don't know, is this some kind of like weird vampire glamoring here? But they trick him into thinking he's eating maggots and worms when it's really Chinese food, rice and noodles.
How could a billion Chinese people be wrong? Yeah, so I love your phrasing to call it vampire glamoring. That is exactly what it is, Queen. You nailed it.
Okay.
It's a form of not necessarily hypnosis, but it's like a projected hallucination where you can force someone to see things that aren't really there. It's mind control is what it is. Yeah. It's like a glamour.
So then David offers Michael next a bottle of wine to drink, and Star says, don't drink it. It's blood. And I guess after all that stuff he just went through, Michael goes, oh, yeah, sure, it's blood. So he drinks it. So I like this scene too, because as he's drinking the blood, we start to get overlapping visual montage, slow-mo, Cry Little Sister, I think again is playing.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads into all the guys dancing around and celebrating that he's drinking it and be one of us and all this. It's really a cool, cool scene.
Visually, the way it looks, you feel like you're tripping balls a little bit. You're feeling what he's feeling and you're getting that because of the music and the way everything sounds. And particularly if you watch it, this movie has been so well preserved, and on Blu-ray, it looks and sounds brand spanking new. It's wonderful. The surround sound of the voices is just really amazing. And I have to say, there have definitely been moments where I sort of wish my name was Michael, because I love the sound of Kiefer Sutherland whispering the name, Michael, Mike. And it's coming from everywhere. It's so fucking cool. You're like, okay, I don't care how scary whatever is going to happen to him is. I kind of wish I was Michael right now. This is kind of cool.
I always wanted to be Star. She had the best hair and the best costume.
I mean, that skirt is everything, honey. The costume people had a field day with her too.
So then we cut to now, the guys all taking Michael out to that train trestle where they're all going to jump off and hang from the bottom railing as a train passes overhead. And you can tell they've done this numerous times to like get their rocks off. Like they're like, yeah, like partying, and they love it when the train goes over.
I almost picture them hanging out with Cliff someday from Dead Man on Campus. Like he'd be into it.
Yeah. For sure.
All right. Yeah. The way it's shot yet again, though, with the fog and the sound of the train. And then when it passes, the way that they're just still hanging there, and you can see on Jason Patrick's face, he's such a great actor. You can see like he is starting to become very afraid that they are going to lose their grip. The tension without having to say or do much is there.
So they all start to let go one by one, and David is the last one hanging there, and he tells him, you're one of us, let go. Michael resists, but eventually, like you said, he loses his grip and he falls. And what a really cool fade shot of him falling and through the fog, and he's terrified. But then when he realizes he's floating for a minute, and he's all like, just the look on his face, like you said, he's like, whoa, what's going on? Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes right back to screaming and falling again.
And then just cut to him falling onto his bed. Like he probably doesn't even realize how he got home or got to bed either. So we don't need to see how it happened.
This scene kills me though, because if
yes,
you know me, see his filthy clothes and shoes, and right on his pillow, he just falls on bed, just filthy.
With his shoes
on, right on the pillow. I got up and paced circles for a minute. I couldn't take it.
Really gross, sir.
So bad. So now Lucy calls the boys on their rotary phone and asks Michael to stay home tonight with Sam so that she can go on a dinner date with her boss, Max. So now we cut to later. Grandpa is getting ready for his date with the widow Johnson.
And he needs something that might pass as aftershave.
And I love Sam hands him the Windex and the face he makes when Grandpa uses it as aftershave.
And he does that little laugh. I just call it the little Corey laugh, the little thing that he does. Like, it's adorable. It's so funny.
Yes.
Oh my God. But Grandpa's really using Windex as aftershave. And that's very disturbing.
So Michael comes in and makes a snarky comment to Grandpa as he's leaving. And I like when Grandpa leaves, his car horn is La Cucaracha.
Yes, but it doesn't quite sound right.
I've always wanted a car that had a random horn like that, but you just don't get that in these newer cars.
Nope. My favorite thing, though, is Sam asking Michael if he has so much attitude because he's been watching too much Dynasty lately. That's an odd reference for a 14-year-old boy.
Yes. And then also he gives him shit for having an earring because Michael got an earring, but Sam has an earring too. So.
Well, he says it's not you. The problem is he's seeing these dramatic personality changes and he knows his brother. Like, that's not his personality to be running around in a leather jacket, piercing his ear and staying out all night. Like, are you freebasing? Inquiring minds want to know. Another great line from Sam. He has the best dialogue in the movie.
Suddenly it appears as they're standing there talking that David and the Garden Snake motorcycle gang here have all shown up to raise some hell. Like the lights, the noises. I love the effect of the shutters moving and the wind howling.
And then nothing. Once again, it's like you said, like a vampire glamour. I love it. It's like a projected hallucination you're forcing somebody to have. There's nothing there. How bizarre that they're both experiencing that.
So then Michael's really confused about what's happening. And I love that he just tells Sam, go take your bath. Like he's 10.
Is he 14 or 5? Yeah. But you know what? It doesn't matter. I want him to go take his bath because by him taking his bath, we get Ain't Got No Home by Clarence Frogman Henry, which is not on the official soundtrack, but is one of the most memorable things in this movie. Is it not? Him sitting in the bathtub singing along to that song is so fucking glorious. And when he's playing with the comb and he drops it and... When he drops it, like he looks like he's having
the best bath of his life.
I know.
And he's got his dog there. He's got a positive attitude. Like he's enjoying his life
this,
right now.
This kid is just pure happiness right now. He's so cute.
So Michael pulls out a half gallon of milk, this old paper half gallons. And of course they have the I'm missing picture on it of a boy. And it turns out to be the young boy that was hanging out with Star. And Michael gets, I guess, an intense pain in his stomach and his face tells you immediately what's happening. He drops that milk and he heads up to the bathroom and it's so intense. There's tension. He's on his way up and you just know he's up to no good. Vampire shit is a-stirring within him.
Yeah, you're getting all of that without anyone needing to tell you. You're just seeing it and you're figuring he went to consume human food and his body went, no, that's not what you want. He's feeling that for the first time. I think what makes this movie, one of the things that makes it so great and unique is they focus so much on what it would be like to transition from a human being to a vampire, that it would not happen instantly. It would be a very painful and confusing process, much like puberty and or growing up. I love that. That's a big focus on how confusing and painful it would be to have to change.
So as Michael is getting ready to fling that door open to the bathroom, his eyes look like they've changed a little, or is that just me?
Yep. It's almost, the color hasn't changed, but they look like milky, like they're glossed over. So it's like, it seems like his personality is leaving his body. Like he is just not even in control of what he's doing anymore. He seems animalistic.
So he flings that door open and Nanook jumps him and they get knocked down the stairs. And poor little Sam's been underwater, so he has no idea what just happened.
He was having tubby time.
So Sam goes downstairs and finds that Nanook bit Michael to protect him. After seeing Michael's reflection now in a mirror is fading away, Sam freaks out, runs upstairs, calling him a vampire.
You wait till mom finds out.
Yes. Wait till mom finds out. That's like one of my favorite things he says.
Yeah.
So Sam takes Nanook and he locks himself in his room and calls the Frog Brothers. He had to pray he never needed to call them, but guess what?
They might be right.
So they establish quickly that Michael is indeed a vampire, and they tell Sam to kill him. And Sam says, well, I can't do that. He's my brother. And he hangs up on him.
That's what's so great about Sam is that he is there as the person to remind you that Michael is still his brother and he is still a human being. He is in the middle of this change. He hasn't completely changed. He hasn't lost who he is. Sam is going, wait a minute, I get that we should kill vampires, but he's not completely a vampire and he's my brother and he's still a person. Well, aren't all vampires former people? So at what point do they lose their humanity? And you're seeing someone who's on the verge of losing their humanity. It just gives it more of an emotional impact. So Corey Haim as Sam is what gives you that in this movie.
So I love this next touch with Michael. He's involuntarily flying now because he floats up and he can't control it, it seems.
It's not like you would just wake up and know how to do it.
Yeah, it's so cool. So it ends up pulling him outside and out the window, and he ends up in front of Sam's window while Sam is on the phone with his mom. And this whole exchange between them is so hilarious because he's screaming bloody murder.
And then when he gets off the phone, my favorite thing he does is he's trying to like make a cross with his fingers and he can't figure out which one should be in front. So he's just back and forth. It's just one of these adorable little Corey Haim things that he's doing that's just so endearing. And then he has one of the best lines of the movie.
Yeah, Lucy hangs up and we see her rush out on her date with Max and is going to go home to save Sam because he's hysterical.
So Sam looks at Michael flying / floating outside his window and he's like, you're a vampire. I knew it. And Michael, just like a typical older brother in a fight, is like, I am not. And Sam says, so what are you, the flying nun? And the face he makes when he says it is just everything. He realizes, yes, you're a vampire or you're turning into one, but you're also really freaked out, just like I am. So the little brother, he just grabs him and pulls him in like, hey, we're going to figure this out. Because Michael's scared too, and he's not an adult, and he's not a vampire yet. He's a confused teenager. He has no idea what's happening to him.
So Sam agrees that they can keep it a secret from mom so Michael can figure out what's going on. And she comes rushing in. And I like that Sam's excuse is, I was reading a horror comic and I got really scared. And she's like, what? He was screaming way too much bloody murder for that to be from reading, but okay.
Exactly.
So Michael takes off and Sam asks his mom if he can sleep with her. And I like that she goes, were you eating pizza?
Smell like garlic. And he opens his robe and he's got a necklace made of bulbs of garlic. But the best thing about it to me, because I've seen it so many times, is not the garlic, it's the t-shirt underneath, because if you can see it, it says born to shop.
Yes. I was like,
choice.
So much is in there, I'm telling you.
So strange.
So now we cut to Max arriving home because, you know, Lucy ran out on him. And did you notice when he arrives home, his little front gate he has to go through, the sign on his gate? As many times as you've seen this movie, do you remember what that sign says?
No.
So because he has his dog, Thorn, it's a beware of dog sign. However, this one had to be made for the movie because it says, trespassers will be eaten.
Eaten, not bitten.
Eaten. Yep. Pretty funny, right?
That's fucking glorious. Maybe it's, I have intentionally overlooked that subconsciously all these years because I don't want it spoiled that Max is a vampire. So I ignore it because I don't want to know.
I went nuts when I saw that.
Beyond genius. I need one and I'm not going to tell you why. It has nothing to do with my cats. We'll just put it that way. That's amazing. Trespassers will be eaten.
So then as he goes through his gate, the wind starts to kick up. We hear noises, kind of like when Michael was glamored earlier, and we start to think, oh no, he's going to be attacked by the gang. And then he gets startled by a kite that looks like a bat. And I was like, okay, movie, I love you, but really, come on. Nobody's flying a kite at 8 o'clock at night.
No, they're a bunch of little punk ass teenagers fucking with dad because they have nothing to do. And they're pissed that he has this master plan and they're just his little soldiers having to do what he wants them to do. They're getting really fucking bored. So they're messing with him.
That tracks. So we cut to Michael now arriving at the cave where nobody's really around because, like you said, they're out fucking with dad. He does find Star and little Laddie, the little boy, he's in there sleeping. So Star and Michael start to make out and have sex, but we don't see it. So again, very tasteful, but I was like, gosh, is this PG-13? Give me something, guys. Come on.
Honestly, I'm happy for it because we're approaching the halfway mark. There hasn't been a whole lot of vampire. So I'm starting to get a little antsy going, okay, when is this going to start paying off? This is a lot of buildup, a whole lot of foreplay. We're still going up the first incline and I'm ready. So I appreciate that they get this over with quickly. You see it. And then the immediate cut to the flying again, the shots at, and the use once again of Cry Little Sister. Boy, are they using the hell out of that song. I understand why. I love the shot of flying way high up and then descending into the lower clouds and then into the cave. That's so fucking cool. And this time, you know, it is them and they are flying indeed because they immediately are walking in. So, you know, that's what that means now. Confirmed. I love that.
So now the next day, Michael and Lucy have an awkward chat and he tells his mom, we really can't talk about this because you wouldn't understand. And he goes inside. And I was like, oh, well, at least she's trying.
She thinks she's in that position of, oh, my teenager thinks I wasn't a teenager and I have no idea. That is not what he's talking about, ma'am. You really wouldn't understand. It's something you couldn't understand and something you shouldn't understand. But can we talk about what Sam, once again, is wearing when Michael walks into the house?
This is the worst outfit in the entire movie. And that's saying a lot.
It's one of the worst outfits in the 80s.
Ever to exist.
I would take, like leg warmers and leotards a la Janie and Girls Just Want to Have Fun before I would wear this atrocious, it looks like pajamas, but it also looks like medical scrubs, but it's shorts.
With flip flops and a little poo-poo shell anklelet.
The little stick figures with smiley faces. Who dressed this kid?
For real.
This
the Rob Lowe poster from his bedroom dressed.
Yeah. It has to be so intentional. Rob Lowe comes to life every night and blesses the clothes in his closet.
Lays his outfit out for him.
Exactly.
So later now, Lucy goes to Max's house to leave a bottle of wine as an apology for rushing out on him the other night. And she gets chased by Thorn, Max's dog. What a great tense scene.
I love a moment that makes you terribly afraid in broad daylight. There's just something off-putting about it. And the bright sunshine, the way it's all lit and shot.
Yeah.
That dog seemed like such a good boy, such a sweet dog. And all of a sudden, he is clearly out for blood if you come any closer to the house.
Gotta be careful. Trespassers will be eaten.
That's right.
So then later now at the comic shop, Sam, who witnessed all of this with his mom and the dog, is telling the Frog Brothers that the dog was acting like a hound of hell chasing his mom. And they discuss how vampires employ hounds of hell to kind of be a guardian over them, like when they're sleeping during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt cheated because we get a quick mention by one of the Frog Brothers that they know that there are vampires everywhere and they even suspect werewolves and ghouls in City Hall. And that never comes back ever later. And I was like, that's the sequel I wanted.
Right. I think it's just sort of meant to be a commentary on not only do kids have something going for them by still believing in monsters and having a great imagination, but they maybe also are onto something that we lose as adults, which is we should be suspicious of the man at all times. I think they're onto something.
I don't want to encourage that too much because then we go down the rabbit hole into lizard people and I'm not going to go there.
Let's not.
So they basically land on Max is probably the head vampire and we need to look into him, they decide.
Right. But before that, they just tell him simple advice, kill your brother, you'll feel better. I love that Sam is written to be smart enough to realize they're not going to help him because they want to help him save Michael. The way to get their help is to appeal to their ego by telling them you'll be heroes, you'll save the whole town. Now they're on board with figuring it out. He's a smart little cookie.
So that night we see Lucy is making a family dinner and she has asked Max over to join them.
And Grandpa's very upset about this.
He says, we have to have company again.
She's like, you haven't had anybody over in 8 years, Dad.
Yes, and now we're having it again.
Once again, I would love to think that I'm cool, but actually I'm Grandpa.
Hey, I was Walter, so that's fine. So Michael is on his way out, and this is the only other issue that I take with this movie. So again, you'll have to maybe explain it and reel me back in. He's on his way out, and Max is at the front door, and he says, well, I'm not coming in because you're the man of the house, and I'm not coming in unless you invite me. This is Grandpa's house. Michael's not the man of the house.
Anyone who lives there qualifies as someone who can invite you in and thus bend the vampire rules. First of all, anyone who lives there, it doesn't have to be the man of the house.
He says that though. He says, well, Michael, you're the man of the house.
Because he's trying to play to Michael's ego, and he's trying to make it appear as if he is very concerned about the woman he's interested in's son being okay with them having dinner. He's trying to make it look like what it's supposed to look like. If he was like, where's your grandfather? I need to ask his permission to come. Huh? What?
That's why I questioned the rules, though, because later he points out, you don't invite somebody into your house, that renders you powerless. And I'm like, what?
Michael lives there. Anyone who lives there could have invited him in.
All right, I'll roll with it. So Max and Lucy have a sweet moment and they kiss by the table there. And then they get interrupted when Sam comes in and says that he brought Edgar and Alan for dinner. And then I like how Grandpa is back in his taxidermy room, which has like the sliding doors, and he's given Max side eye and he slowly closes the doors.
I love that, because first viewing, you're thinking Grandpa is just one kooky motherfucker. And then rewatch, you're going, okay, Grandpa is very suspicious and knows exactly what's going on here. He's keeping his eyes open and he's a little old man, so he can't do much, but he can definitely be aware and be careful. He's concerned about what's happening.
So then next we get a scene, to me, is some of the best comedy in the entire movie. We get the dinner scene at the table. We've got Sam and the Frog Brothers trying to give Max all these vampire tests. And of course, he passes all of them. We have the bad breath test, tolerance of garlic, holy water, and his reflection in the mirror. Please give me your thoughts just on this scene as a whole.
It's shot brilliantly. The way it's cut together, it's literally like watching the Three Stooges. Physical comedy. It works so well. The way everything is just careening downhill. Everything's just escalating. So, and you're, as soon as the thing with the garlic happens, you're like, oh, they've made a big mistake. Oh, no. What they're doing now is ruining poor mom's date and just going to embarrass the hell out of this guy for no reason. Like, they have no reason to be suspicious anymore. They should stop, but no, they're going to keep going. By the time you get to the thing with the mirror, and then God bless Edward Herman, the look on his face and the way he screams when he sees himself in the mirror is so funny. And you're just thinking, if I was him, I would want to line them up and slap all three of them in the face. But no, he just excuses himself and says, okay, I guess dinner's over, and he leaves. And you actually feel bad for him, and you feel really bad for Lucy, and you're thinking, shame on these three fools for doing it. Like, oh my God, man, the emotional manipulation. This movie is playing tricks on you when you're watching it for the first time.
So Max tells Lucy he'll make her dinner at his house tomorrow night, and we'll give it a third go around here. And as he's leaving, we get another funny side eye from Grandpa as he's eating behind the door.
He's got his little plate of spaghetti that he went and stole when no one was looking.
Yeah.
Once again, I am Grandpa.
So now we cut to Michael out at the pier, where he confronts David about what's going on. David tells him to come with him and the boys. Let's go. I have something to show you. So the fellas all head out to attack and feed on a group of people partying at a secluded bonfire. This scene, the tree, the hill, the fire, the whole thing is shot brilliantly.
Agreed. It's visually striking. The imagery, every shot is like, if you took a still photo, isn't that interesting to look at? It's so smart, so well done. You're really getting the sense, a lot of the time the vampires are on camera, they're being shot from below. And it gives you this sense that they're looming over you or over Michael and he's underneath them. Like, there's so much smart choices that goes into how these things are shot. And you're right. I love that they're all climbing up. And don't they look like, I don't know, would you call them a herd, a school
of bats?
Of bats perched up, each one on a different branch in the tree.
Their coats are flapping.
And now you're understanding what they're going for. with the way they look. I love it. I love, first of all, like I said, the focus of the transition from human to vampire. I love that. And then that's another thing I love that this movie does with vampires that nobody else has done, which is really heavy on the whole how they're bat-like in their behavior and why they're bat-like in their behavior. I fucking love it. And then you get really the best musical moment in the entire movie from a song that isn't on the soundtrack we're about to have.
I know. I was so disappointed. So they tell Michael, yeah, you're here because you're going to watch us do what we have to do here. So they change into vampires before Michael's eyes. And I like the subtlety where nothing about them physically changes much, except they have the contacts in the eyes and the teeth and just a touch of makeup here and there on their face. Yeah, it's hardly anything, but they look so terrifying because of the acting. Yeah.
Whoever came up with the idea for the makeup design, the furrowed brow and the protruding forehead. It's so subtle. It's so effective and good. That combined with the contacts and the fangs, and then you have to act behind that makeup. And I love this moment where not only does David reveal his face by moving into the light, it's gorgeous. Then they give you each of the four of them just loving being a vampire, and they all look like they're having the best fucking time and they are about to party. Now we're going to show you what it's all about. I love you see all four of them, and there's just something so fucked up and menacing about the way they're getting so excited when you realize what they're about to do. It's so messed up, and I'm here for it because I'm like, yay, we finally reached the peak and now we're rolling downhill on the roller coaster. Woohoo!
So you got this band of, I don't know, surfer punks and whatnot. They look like they're rejects from the cast of Back to the Beach, partying right around this bonfire.
Did Jamaica Scott all night, and now they're off to drink some more.
For real. Got their PBR and they got their boombox blaring, and it's Walk This Way. Which, again, like you said, I wish it was on the soundtrack. So let's just talk about the scene for a second visually, the attack on these, the feeding frenzy, as I like to call it.
Yeah, that is how bats behave.
That's
this
is your R rating, right?
A herd of carnivorous birds, that this is how they behave. I fucking love that. And I love the way they're mixing in. He mixes in those shots where you're in the vampire POV swooping down from above, but then you're also getting outside of it. You're seeing really, really quick outside third party shots, like from Michael's perspective of Marco biting somebody's neck open and someone ripping someone's skull clean off. It happens so fast and is so cool to look at visually, the cut, 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 and all the different angles. And you feel like this huge level of anxiety and like, oh my God, it's tension. It creates so much tension the way it unfolds in front of you. I can't say enough about it. This is the best scene in the entire movie. I back this up and watch it 3 or 4 times every time I watch the movie because I'm a sicko.
That's why we love you.
Yes.
So then to me, we get next what I think is the best shot and line in the movie.
Oh yeah.
After this feeding frenzy, we see David and the guys coming up with their back lit. And they're coming up to the top of this perch to look down at Michael, and they're all standing there. And David says, and they don't look vamped out anymore. They're back to normal. And he says, you'll never get old. You'll never die, but you must feed. That to me is the best shot visually. And that's such an iconic phrase now.
It looks amazing. Yeah. And it's such a great line. It's delivered perfectly. I love anytime the vampires are around, everything is lit very red. I can't stop saying how many great choices were made during the making of this movie. And then you add in the score. I don't think it gets enough credit. This wonderful orchestral thing with the organ, and it sounds so sinister. The score is just so brilliant in this movie. The pop songs and the soundtrack music, but then also the actual scored music is incredible. And it is the exclamation point on that moment. I love it.
So then after all this, Michael is distraught and he goes to Sam, who says, well, I can help you if you tell me who the head vampire is, because they realize now, oops, it's not Max. They get interrupted though when Star shows up, and she and Michael have, this is such a great scene. They have this back and forth quick conversation, but Sam is hiding under the blanket and throwing in his 2 cents.
The way he's just like finishing their sentences and interjecting and the terrified look on his face, and he'll scream and look really angry and then look terrified the minute he's done. Ask like Corey fucking Haim, ladies and gentlemen. He's so great. Like he was hilarious and so adorable. My favorite thing is when Michael is talking to Star and he says something about that was blood. I did drink blood. Sam just interjects. You drank blood? Are you crazy? And then he looks at him like, I'm so gonna tell mom. Like, it's so funny.
So they basically say that Michael and Star and little Laddie are actually all only half vampires because they haven't killed anybody yet. And Star wants Michael's help. He sort of scoffs at her and rejects her. So she just takes off out the window and leaves. Sam calls for reinforcements, though.
Not before telling her, don't kill anybody till I get back to you. And Sam's got connections. So what's he going to do?
So now it's cue the music and here come the Frog Brothers.
God.
I love this. They are so Monster Squad to me in this moment.
Abso-fucking-lutely. Where is Nosferatu, the Prince of Darkness, Nightcrawler, Bloodsucker, El Vampiro? So stupid. So ridiculous.
They're in their full camo gear.
Yeah, what the fuck? They are on a mission, but yes. They also need to borrow someone's car because they live bicycles.
Yes, they're on their little bicycles. And you can tell in this moment, though, when they're showing up now, that we are now full steam ahead to the finale. We are rolling downhill now. So Michael and Sam and the Frog Brothers commandeer Grandpa's car. Grandpa's outside. This was always weird to me. Putting up very large pencil point sharp fence posts in his yard for some reason. Why would they need
for to some reason? No. He knows good and goddamn well that there are vampires everywhere. And he knows that they are attempting to infiltrate his family and his house. He knows Max is a vampire. He knows what the kids are off to do. He knows Michael's turning into one. He knows exactly what's going to happen. And he is getting ready. And he has to make it look like he doesn't know. So that is why he is building a very, very large and pointy fence.
Quote unquote.
Sure, it's a fence, Grandpa. I see you. Like I said, I am Grandpa.
So the Motley crew here take that car and they drive to the Cave Hideaway, the vampire B&B, if you will. Frog Brothers are doing a weapons check as they're getting ready to go inside. And all I can think is these two boneheads are going to save the day.
Which is exactly what Michael expresses. Like, really? These are the guys that are going to help us figure this all out? Okay.
Michael says, yeah, you're sending them down there and I can't protect you. You know, I'm too weak. And this is so sweet. Sam says, well, this time I'll protect you. Even though you're a vampire, you're still my brother.
Oh,
I love them so much. So they go in, and then again, somebody says exactly what I was thinking 3 seconds earlier. Edgar says, oh, vampire hotel. So they see Star sleeping, and Michael stops the Frog Brothers from staking her. Sam and the frogs now are going to go look for more vampires as Michael takes Laddie and Star up to the car one by one. So inside, the boys find David and the crew all vamped out, sleeping, hanging upside down by their feet in a dank little hole. Oh my God.
I love it. Like I said, the whole they're bat-like. You take that idea and kind of run with it and give us better, cooler behavior and visuals than I've seen done with vampires before. I fucking love it. If you think about it, when they're sleeping and the sun is out, they're not aware of their surroundings. They're not listening. They're sleeping so deeply that they're extremely vulnerable. Now you get why vampires hang out in groups, why they would want to live in deep, dank caves away from the sun and where people can't find them when they're vulnerable, or would choose to sleep in coffins where they feel safe and protected from the outside elements. It makes sense. So I love that. The whole cave is a giant coffin, as Edgar points out.
So this scene has just a little thing where I kind of go, really? For the rest of the movie, from this point on, I have to, not that I wouldn't anyway, because it's a vampire movie, but I have to completely just throw it all out the window because everything is ridiculous. There's no way that these guys who think they're going to be vampire killers are this stupid, or maybe they are, to think that they can stake one and the rest of them aren't going to fucking wake up. Are you serious? You think you're going to get away with, because they say, well, we don't know which one is David, so we'll just stake them all, starting with the small one. Sorry, Alex Winter. But it's like, you think you're going to be able to stake them all, really?
They talk a big game, but they've literally never done this before. They have no idea what they're doing. They are just children and they are terrified. So I completely forgive the stupidity because they are naive and they are children. And part of them probably just feels like they can't even believe this is really happening. And they just have no idea what to do. What are they going to do? Spread out and stake all three and hope that one of the three is the head vampire? Like none of them wants to have to do it. It's bad enough to have one of them do it.
So Edgar decides, okay, he's going to drive a stake right through little Marco's heart. And this is the only goof to me visually that I could catch by the director and the editor in the whole movie. They show a close-up of him holding the stake, getting ready to put it through the vampire. And you can see the three sections at the front where it's a retractable stake.
Yeah.
Then they cut to him staking him and it's not retractable. It's back to being a full wooden. And I thought, well, they did that backwards. Shouldn't the close-up of it been not showing that it's the retractable one?
Oops. Yeah. Yeah.
That's the only visual goof I found in the whole movie.
Whoopsie daisy.
So they stake Marco, and as he's screaming and thrashing, he sprays glitter blood all over everybody, which I love actually, but come on.
I would just like to say for the haters, the people who hate glittering vampires a la Twilight, this movie, which is often referred to as the best or coolest vampire depiction or movie of all time, not by just me, but by a lot of people, is actually responsible for glitter and vampires being associated. So I think it looks cool as shit, especially when there's a lot of light reflected when they get out in the sun. There is something a little bit unicorny and magical about being a vampire. So why can't it be glitter? Damn it. Vampires like pretty things.
So they wake up, obviously, the rest of the vampires when this is happening, and the boys manage to escape the cave, but David does grab hold of Sam's foot, and as it drags into the sunlight, it bursts into flames. And I do like the touch of zooming in on David's face, and he's got like a single tear running down. That's kind of cool.
I love it. Fun side note is I've seen this movie so many times, so I am aware of all the behind the scenes and stories and things. That actually wasn't really intentional. Kiefer Sutherland didn't mean to have his eyes tear up and cry. It was because the contacts were driving him insane. Those are real big, heavy, hard lenses, which are very uncomfortable and painful to wear for hours and hours and hours at a time. So actually that was just, he was in pain. Literally in physical pain from his contacts. But I absolutely love any excuse to stare at that makeup. It takes a lot to be able to emote through prosthetics on your face, and they all pull it off really, really well. You're getting a range of facial expressions and emotions from the vampires, and I fucking love it. So I want to see all makeup, all vampire for the rest of the movie. Thank you very much.
So they all run out to get in the car. And like you said, they're covered in that glitter blood. And it actually looks pretty amazing outside.
I think it's cool.
And then I thought they got in that car. I was like, oh, poor car. But Star, Laddie, and Michael are passed out in the back seat. So the boys jump in. Sam's going to drive. And they zip home to Grandpa's house, where they all go in and get stopped. They look so suspicious. And Grandpa stops them. And you're like, oh, shit. And he just goes, something about, did you fill the car with gas? When you take the car, you're supposed to fill it with gas.
Do you know the rule about filling it up with gas? Well, now you do.
What?
Like I said, this man knows exactly what's going on. And he anticipated them showing back up like this in some kind of state. And he anticipates that they're being followed by vampires. And that's why he has the giant stakes. And that's why he's getting them ready.
So Michael and Star and Laddie crash out in one of the upstairs bedrooms. And Sam and the Frog Brothers take off. Sam rushes to the video store, though, in the next scene to tell his mom about the vampires and what's happening. And he's ranting and raving. And she turns it into he's upset that she's going out with Max. So she dismisses him. And I was like, that's kind of the way they want it, though, right? Like, the boys want to kind of just handle this.
Yeah, I mean, he's a kid. So his instinct is to run to a grown-up, someone who might know how. But then you realize it. Like I was saying earlier, the kid's readiness to believe in monsters is what makes them the only people who are capable of fighting, a la the Monster Squad. So it's actually that childlike imagination is the only reason they can fight the vampires is because they believe they exist. The adults who don't believe in them can't.
So the boys set off for supply hunting for plan B because they realize they only have a couple hours till sundown and the vampires will be coming for them. So they ride their bikes to a local church to collect holy water. I love this so much because nobody says anything and the scene is a riot. So Sam tells Grandpa when they get back to the house, the Widow Johnson called and you're supposed to pick her up at 7 and instead of 8. And for him, it's news to him. He's like, what? We had a date tonight? Maybe he picks up that they're shooing him out. I'm not sure, but.
Oh, he's totally, totally onto them. He knows exactly what's happening. So what's he going to do? He's going to probably go hide out in one of the other buildings on the property. He's going to attach those stakes to the front of the car and he is going to sit and wait until shit's going down and swoop in and do what he got
to
do.
You know, that never occurred to me until right now when you said that those posts are all on the front of his car in the mm-hmm. finale. You're right. They're not on the back.
Yeah. He was just pretending to stick them in the dirt. I guarantee you they're all just still sitting there. And the minute Sam tells him to leave, he leaves and then he sneaks right back onto the property with his lights off and gets to work getting ready. He knows exactly what he's doing.
So after he heads out, the boys try to fortify the windows and doors. They prep for the attack, which includes filling a tub upstairs with garlic and holy water, and then they load up their squirt guns with it. I thought that's so smart.
Again, yeah, something children would think of, right? That is so smart. A grown-ass adult wouldn't think of that. Like, brilliant. Use water guns.
So the sun sets. David and Paul and Dwayne, who are the other vampires in the gang. And we mentioned earlier that Alex Winter was the little one, Marco. But we've got Brooke McCarter and Billy Worth as Paul and Dwayne here. So the three of them vamp out, take off in flight out of the cave, which we don't see them. We get a POV shot, which is really cool. Then we cut to Max and Lucy having dinner at Max's. And his apartment decor or house decor is very 80s, and it always makes me giggle. I can't help it. It's like this movie is just reeks of 80s and all the set design.
A lot of neon, a lot of triangles. What is that? Why the neon and triangles?
So Lucy tells Max about Sam ranting earlier at the store, and he finds that very interesting. Then we cut back to Sam now, running outside to get Nanook because the vampires are quickly approaching overhead. I thought to myself, did they put him out there on purpose to be a warning for when the vampires were coming or what? Because he's tied to the gate.
So Nanook was freaking out when they first got back because of Michael, Laddie, and Star. They've gotten to a point where the dog is constantly recognizing them as vampires. And he was barking up a storm. And Michael quickly said to Sam, take Nanook outside. So they had to get him outside and away from them so that they could do what they need to do and not have him hurt any of them. And then Sam forgot that he was out there.
Okay. Well, he was tied all the way up the property at the front gate. And I was like, holy shit, the dog can't die or I'm going to hate this movie. So they just grab Nanook, make it back inside. And this is where everything now starts to move really fast. And I appreciate this in a slam bang finale of a movie.
Definitely. You've been patiently waiting and now here comes the payoff.
So the Frog Brothers, Star and Laddie, run upstairs. Star and Laddie then have to run off alone because Edgar pulls out a wooden stake, threatening them. And then downstairs, this was weird to me, Dwayne, the dark hair vampire, comes busting up in a really badass shot, flying up out of the bottom of the stone fireplace right at Sam and Michael. I don't know how he did that.
But so you have an opening, you have a crawl space underneath your fireplace. And that's an easy way to get in. It's an opening. So remember when the Frog Brothers and Sam were trying to find the vampires, they looked for drafts in the cave and followed the movement of the air to find a way to where the vampires were. That's exactly what bats do. That's exactly what birds do. That's what he's doing. He's following a draft in the crawl space to find an opening into the house. It's actually really smart.
It's a really badass shot. I love it.
And then you get that amazing shot of, it shows you their strength. He busts through solid brick to get to them. Fuck, run.
Yes. And then we cut real quick now to upstairs where we have vampire Paul, the blonde, confronting the Frog Brothers. He gets killed when Nanook, the MVP of the motherfucking film, does a jump and side kick, pushing him into the tub of garlic water. Yes, Nanook for the win. Because the Frog Brothers are sitting there holding each other, cowering.
They are fucking terrified. They look like they're peeing their pants. Yeah, they are not about to stake another vampire, especially not one that's walking and talking and is huge and looming over them. I fucking love it. Nanook for the win. He's in the tub and then they're getting kind of cocky. They're moving closer. And the way he shoots up out of the fucking tub, and now you're seeing, okay, R rating, that makeup, the way his face is starting to come apart.
Melting almost.
Holy shit. It's so disturbing and gross looking. It is so scary. And he grabs them and they are screaming, and that is genuine fear and terror on their faces, because that is goddamn scary.
And then he turns full skeleton, melts away, and then all of a sudden blood and water shoots out of every faucet and pipe in the house and even breaks the toilet.
Apparently, when you have a lot of glitter blood accumulating at once, it creates pressure. It has its own magical inertia to it, where it's just flowing out of everything. That is some, yeah, that, no wonder drinking it fucks you up, right?
So downstairs, Michael is passed out on the floor because they were knocked over by that explosion, and the room goes dark. Sam gets grabbed by Vampire Dwayne, who carries him up into the air by his head and neck, and then drops him when Sam thinks really fast and grabs that squirt gun of garlic water and sprays him in the face.
Yes.
I love it because the scene is terrifying if you think about what's really happening to sweet little Sam. And then he goes, boop, 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 with the squirt gun.
There you go. Quick thinking. And he's actually a lot braver than the Frog Brothers are in this moment, isn't he? Because he's acting quickly and doing what he has to do. But I appreciate that this is actually the first time really that you're seeing a vampire fly in the movie. And they're very, very quick to get on, get off the green screen. Let's not do too much because it doesn't look great. It's an effect that didn't work very well back then. And, you know, only with today's technology does it look seamless. So they're very quick out of it. And then they use this great, the actors are suspended and we're doing close-ups of their faces, and you get that they're moving and flying and that they're in the air, but without seeing the full body, that kind of ruins the illusion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that. So the way it's shot is just, once again, smart choices, really, really good, because yeah, it looks like he's got him up off the ground, and that's really fucking scary.
So then we get next what is my favorite death in the film.
Oh, yeah.
As I'm sure it is a lot of people's. Sam shoots an arrow at Vampire Dwayne, and he fakes being hit and falls to the ground. And then we get a fun little jump scare because he pops back up and he's all, ha ha, you didn't get me. I love that. But then Sam shoots him again, and he goes flying backwards into a stereo system setup and gets somehow effectively electrocuted by this, and his head explodes. You get sparks flailing, the music, the screeching of this.
You get in excess. Again, thank you. Yeah, oh my God. Well, I mean, Edgar said it, like, some vampires implode, some explode, some will try to take you with them. Like, it's always gory. There you go. Like we were saying, you're getting the payoff. Like, holy shit. Now I understand the R rating completely. I wasn't here for sex. I wasn't here for cuss words. I was here for blood and guts, and damn it, now we're getting it.
It is a glorious explosion, a great death.
And then you get the best line, in my opinion, death by stereo. Like, holy shit. Sam is so pleased with himself that right? Not only did he single-handedly take a vampire out, but then he also did it in a really, really fucking cool rock and roll way.
Yes.
I'm loving it.
I will forever feel cheated that we didn't get a Sam and the Frog Brothers sequel. I'm devastated by that. So Sam goes upstairs, and then David and Michael start this fight that we get a back and forth shots of with the flying, but we don't actually see them full flying, so it doesn't ruin it by being cheesy.
Yep.
But then we cut away once that starts back up to Sam and the frogs, who are startled by little Laddie when he bursts up through a bed screaming and flailing because he's all vamped out now. I didn't understand that because he hasn't made a kill yet. So would he be full vampire yet? I don't know the logic there.
My guess is where they're going with it is you can only put off your first kill for so long. Eventually, the thirst will overtake you. It won't matter where you are, who you're around. Like, eventually, you won't be able to fight it off anymore, and it'll just overcome you, and you will kill whoever's near you. And that's what's happening to this poor kid.
He scares the shit out of them and runs to the corner to hide. And I love that Alan, I think it's Alan, says that great line here.
Yep. It's the attack of Eddie Munster. This little kid, but the makeup, just even on a little kid on that little face, so yep. fucking cool and intimidating looking. I mean, he doesn't look like Twisted Sister. That guy's in the bathtub. I love that line too. We got the one that looks like Twisted Sister. Poor little Eddie Munster though. Come on. He's just a kid. You need to help him. You still haven't killed the head vampire.
Well, Star busts in to protect him from the Frog Brothers. And then we cut quickly back down to Michael and David still fighting. And it culminates with Michael impaling David on a pair of antlers in the taxidermy room. And this scene, this shot, once again, smoke, lighting, music, everything coming together to make a brilliantly shot scene.
Absolutely. It's, to me, the coolest thing to look at visually in the whole movie is this moment of David dying. The way that, first of all, the dialogue, like you were saying, I love that David says to Michael, you know, you can't fight it anymore. My blood is in your veins. And Michael says, so is mine. And that's when he pushes back and pushes him. I love that. Like, you may think you have control over me, sir, but I am still who I am, who I always have been. And you can't control that. I'm in control. I fucking love that. It's really empowering and cool. And then the switch in the lighting is my favorite thing. Everything's been so red and saturated as David is dying and he changes from a vampire to just a teenage boy. This actually is just a poor kid who got caught up in all this too, to this bright angelic white light. I love that. It's like the evil left his body. And what you're left with is this is just a kid who at some point was, you know, had nowhere to go.
So everyone gathers around downstairs now and they start to realize that nothing has changed. Michael, Star, and Laddie. So David was not the head vampire because they're all still, you know, half vampire. So that's when Max and Lucy show up. Max goes in and sees David's body laying there, and he starts to apologize to Lucy, saying it's his fault that David and his boys misbehaved. So Lucy's obviously confused, and she's like, what is going on? And then Max walks over to the fireplace, and suddenly, through the magic of cinema, there is a roaring fire in there once again. I don't know where that happened. But let's play make-believe. So he's in front of this glorious fireplace and he's explaining that he is the head vampire and he wants Lucy to be his bride and mother to the vampire boys. Sam says, well, how can that be possible? Because you passed our vampire tests. And this is where he points out, you never invite a vampire into your home.
That's just silly.
So Max says he wants to be one big happy family. And this is where we get a great line from Edgar. Great. The blood-sucking Brady Bunch. So Michael, Star, and the Frogs all take turns rushing at Max, and they get tossed like rag dolls. And then he grabs Sam, and he's holding him in a chokehold, and he puts out his hand to Lucy, and he vamps out. His face now is vamped out. So Lucy's going to give in. And just before Max can bite her, we hear La Cucaracha playing.
Thank you, running gag, for setting this up, because you know to associate Grandpa's coming in the truck when you hear that. Genius.
Yep. He comes busting through the doors and a giant wooden fence post goes flying. Max gets impaled and drug into the fireplace and boom goes the dynamite. We get a magnificent explosion once again, smoke and soot everywhere.
Edward Herman, now you're seeing this is why they cast the dude. First of all, he was massive, really, really big, tall guy. So he appears to be stronger and way more physically intimidating and violent than any of those boys were put together. Like, he makes them all look like a bunch of children. And then they do this really cool thing that you can hear where they have this animalistic growl that is an undertone in some of the things he says when he's talking right before they kill him. It's super subtle and you have to really be on the look out for it, but it sounds so fucking cool. And you totally get that he is a different kind of beast. He is completely another level. He's so intimidating and scary. And I fucking love, like I was saying, the running gag with the horn. Now you get why they were doing it. It's so smart. You just know what's going to happen. You know, grandpa's coming in for the win. And then you, if you remember the stakes, you're like, oh my God, is that really? Yep, there it is. When he goes flying into that fireplace, you're like, oh, fuck yeah. I'm right there with Edgar. I want to grab my goggles and put them on and get ready for the explosion. The shot of them wearing their goggles is so funny.
So yeah, after that all happens, I like, yeah, they pull their goggles off and they've got the white rings around their eyes because they're covered in soot otherwise.
Right. And then Edgar, how much do you think we should charge him? What exactly did you do besides watch a dog kill a vampire?
They wore the shit out of that camo. That's what they did.
That's true.
So Grandpa just casually strolls into the kitchen, grabs a root beer, and everyone's following him and standing in the doorway. And Lucy asks if he's okay. And we get one of the best final lines of a movie ever.
The one thing about living in Santa Carla, I never could stomach all the damn vampires.
Yes, and then, the look on their faces.
Like, wait a minute, you knew. And that's exactly what you're thinking. And just the fade out of their faces, like, are you serious right now, Grandpa? And then the choice to use People Are Strange again. Wonderful. It's the perfect ending to a near flawless film. I love it.
Yep, we get that start of the song, fade to black, roll credits, the end.
Yep.
After you've seen the movie, you go back and watch it again, like you said, and you pointed a few things new out to me this time. You can tell he's onto it. He knew.
He's totally aware. That is why he lives the way he lives, where he lives.
Yep.
And being surrounded, here's another thing that might blow your mind. Being surrounded by all this death, it explains why he became obsessed with taxidermy.
Oh, shit.
Hello. He tried to see the silver lining or the positive or make something happy or beautiful out of all this death that he's surrounded by. I love Grandpa.
Oh my God, I love that. You did blow my mind again.
I mean, wow. I'm still waiting to see if he did stuff Mr. Johnson, but.
Right. All right. So instead of three questions today, I just have a couple things I want us to briefly talk about.
Yes, let's.
How do you feel about the reboot movie by Warner Brothers? They want to reboot their own property as a motion picture. Far as I can tell, they've got writers, directors, and two lead characters already involved in the project, two lead actors. What are your thoughts on that?
No, thank you, ma'am. No. Did I not just say this is a near flawless film? There's so much about it that, yes, is distinctly 80s, but there's also a timelessness and there is a level of quality to everything in this movie, as well as how well preserved it is, how great it still looks and sounds. You don't need to do it. Leave it the fuck alone. Please, for the love of God, stop. I've been hearing for years that they were talking about doing a TV series and that they actually filmed it and then went, this sucks, and went back to recast it and redo the whole thing again. Hello, read the room. If it sucks, it's because it's a bad idea. Find something else. I could maybe handle if it's done exactly stylistically the way Joel Schumacher did this movie. If it's all handled with a lot of love and homage and care, new stories that take place in this same world, okay. Remake, go fuck yourself.
That's kind of what I feel like it sounds like they're doing. Yeah, the remake.
No, leave it alone.
I'm with you. This movie by itself is a standalone, doesn't need anything else. However, for people who choose for this to not be a single thing in existence, the Frog Brothers stories go on. So my question to you is, are you familiar with the part two and part three films? Have you seen them? Do you know of them? Thoughts?
Yes, I've seen them both.
Okay. Were you aware that there is actually a 4-book comic series, which I own and have read, that takes place in the 1-year time gap between the end of this film that we discussed today and The Lost Boys 2? It fills in the gap and explains what happened in this world. Mm-hmm. Were you aware of that? Or are you familiar with that?
I have not read it. I just love and appreciate this movie. I did see the other sequels out of morbid curiosity, and that's the end of that. My obsession with this movie is as a standalone movie. I don't worry about anything else that came after it. I've heard of those. I have not read them.
Okay, so for the purposes of full inclusion, because I know we will never cover the other movies or anything ever again, let's throw this in here now. The four-part comic series came out in 2008, right before the release of the film Lost Boys: The Tribe, which was 2008. The film has a critic score of 0, and it was reviewed and has a 0, and an audience score of 25. So the comics, however, fill in the gap, like I said. We find out, if you want to believe this universe goes on, that Grandpa was actually turned half vampire by the Widow Johnson. The Frog Brothers and Sam all battle David and his new gang of vampires, because we find out that David was impaled on animal antlers, not a wooden stake. And because you can't kill a vampire by just stabbing them with anything, David didn't actually die at the end of Lost Boys. He survives. So David and some vampires come back and attack Sam and the Frog Brothers. Alan gets turned in this fight. Grandpa gets killed. And then at the very, very end of the series, we learn that at that bonfire in the Lost Boys, the blonde surfer dude that was hanging out around the fire survives. He doesn't totally get murdered. He survives being bit and turns into a vampire. And his name is Shane, and he survives. So Lost Boys, the tribe, the main character, the main vampire is Shane. That is Angus Sutherland, half-brother to Kiefer. So he lives in the surfer town. He is now has his own tribe, quote unquote, of vampires, and battles with Edgar Frog. And Corey Haim was supposed to be in this film, but unfortunately was battling his own personal demons and was not able to be in the movie. I feel like maybe the movie would have been completely different had Haim been able to be Sam in it.
Maybe. I don't know. It's my take is it's a hot pile of garbage. And honestly, I like to think that only this movie exists. Nothing beyond it exists. And that's as it should be.
The one fun thing in the tribe, though, is we do get another Death by Antlers homage of a human or a half vampire. So it actually does kill them for real. So that was kind of funny to me. And then, of course, in 2010, we got Lost Boys: The Thirst, 0% after being reviewed by critics, but a 33 audience. So a little better than the tribe. And we do get a touching scene in this movie. I liked, actually, of Edgar going to Sam's grave, and he puts the comic down on his grave, the vampires everywhere. And I was like, oh. Anyway, that's all I wanted to say about those, was that they're out there, they exist, they continue the story. The Frog Brothers are in that one, Edgar and Alan, and their glorious performance doesn't save the movie. But I do love the Frog Brothers, and it was fun to see them go on, I thought. Do you have any other closing thoughts, feelings, opinions?
I adore this movie. It is one of the best movies ever, in my opinion. It's the best depiction of vampires, my favorite way they've ever been depicted. It's one of the best movies to come out of the 80s. It's one of my favorite horror movies. Any of those lists, you want to put a movie on it or near the top of it, it's this movie. This movie checks so many boxes for me. I love it so much. Yeah, rest in peace, little Corey Haim. He just was a doll, and he is what I love the most about this movie. Although, you know, Kiefer Sutherland has a lot to do with a lot of how weird I am. His portrayal, the way that he made vampirism look has a lot to do with why I'm fucked up as a human being. So thank you to him and everyone involved in that. But Corey Haim really has become my favorite thing. He's just so endearing and wonderful. I smile so much every time I watch this movie, mostly because of him.
All right. So for everyone listening, if you want to watch The Lost Boys, it is currently available to stream on Netflix or pay streaming on Amazon Prime. And 2 and 3 are also streaming on Amazon Prime, just in case you're curious. I want to thank my co-host for joining me, Miss Nikki Flicks, and happy birthday to you.
Thank you. This was a lovely way to celebrate.
Agreed. And on that note, we will see you all next time. Goodbye.
They're only noodles, Michael.
Hey listeners, Movie Miss here, saying we know you have a lot of options when it comes to podcasts, so we want to thank you so much for listening to ours. Please make sure to find us on our socials and join us. Be part of our bad movie conversations. We want to chat with you. We're on Facebook with an official page, as well as a Let's Talk Turkeys discussion group.
where you can talk with other like-minded individuals who like bad movies. We're on Instagram at Let's Talk Turkeys. Our Twitter handle is at Gobble Podcast. That's GOBBLEPODCAST. And of course, you can always email us direct. We would love to get suggestions from you of movies you would like us to cover. If you want to be a guest on the show, we would love that. So directly, that's Let's Talk Turkeys, all one word, at yahoo.com.
You still here? It's over. Go home. Go.